final lecture this year in our public lecture series on Charles Drew Johnson. Stepping in for the president of St. Anselm Institute this year, John Miller, who's actually away. The St. Anselm Institute, this is your first event, hosts a public lecture series throughout the year. We have a Doctors of the Church faculty student lunch seminar that we host throughout the year, a film series, and a variety of other events. So if you don't know about us, we're on the web. There's also a place that you can sign up if you want to get onto our mailing list. So today we have a very special guest for the annual Robert Lewis Wilkin Lecture, which commemorates the research writing, teaching, and service of Robert Lewis Wilkin, the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of History of Christianity Emeritus at the University of Virginia. Robert has been and remains an inspiration and friend to many of us here at UVA and beyond. As many know, he also was one of the founders of the St. Anselm Institute, and he continues to be very active in many things, including as a very benevolent and exemplary chairman of the St. Anselm Institute's board. 5 years ago, at Robert's retirement from UVA, the Institute's faculty steering committee decided to designate one of our public lectures each year as the Robert Lewis Wilkin Lecture. 4 years ago, we invited Robert back to the university to give a public lecture in this very room. And it was at that lecture that we surprised him with an engraved Jefferson Cup and designated his talk as the inaugural Robert Lewis Wilkin Lecture. The past 2 years, historians Thomas Noble and Brad Gregory, both at the University of Notre Dame, were invited to give the second and third annual lectures. This year, we are very pleased and honored that Sidney Griffith accepted our invitation to give the fourth Robert Lewis Wilkin Lecture. As a sign of our gratitude, at the conclusion of my introduction, I will give Father Griffith a similarly engraved Jefferson Cup as a remembrance of this event and of our time with him. Sidney Griffith is the professor of Semitic languages at the Catholic University of America, where he's been since 1977. Sidney has served as director of the graduate program in early Christian studies at Catholic U for 15 years, and also as the departmental chair twice, I believe, for more than a decade. He also has held additional appointments at the Dunbarton Oaks Center for Byzantine Studies, Princeton Theological Seminary, Institute for Advanced Studies, and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He is the author of scores of scholarly articles, and I do mean scores, and several seminal books, including The Church in the Shadow of the Mosque, Christian and Muslims in the World of Islam, which Princeton published, and a forthcoming and much anticipated book, The Bible in Arabic, The Scriptures of the People of the Book in the Language of Islam, which I believe is forthcoming next month, also from Princeton. Given the occasion, I think it's fitting that I extend these formal remarks by reading the words that Robert Wilkin has written about his friend Sidney Griffith. Sidney Griffith has been a pioneer among Catholic historians. He has devoted his life to the study of Eastern Christianity, but not that of Greek-speaking Byzantine Christianity, nor that of the Slavic-speaking world of Eastern Europe, but to the Syriac and Arabic-speaking Christian world in the Middle East. More than any other historian in this country, Sidney Griffith has opened up a chapter in the history of Christianity that is known only to a handful of specialists. In the early centuries, Christianity spread east of Jerusalem into present-day Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and even into Central Asia, China, and India. These Christians spoke Syriac, a Semitic language, and missionaries to the east carried the gospel and translated the scriptures into Syria. After the rise of Islam, many of these Christians adopted Arabic as their language, with the result that a tradition of Arabic-speaking Christianity arose that is still alive in the Middle East. Robert continued, "Most Westerners know nothing of this world, and Sidney Griffith has published a series of books and articles over the past 3 decades introducing English readers to the rich cultural world of Arabic-speaking Christianity. In this world was where Christianity first came face-to-face with Islam, and Christians learned to relate to this new religion. In many articles, Griffith has presented the thinking of the first Arabic-speaking Christian theologians. He has translated the first Our ideas discussed the first translators of the Bible into Arabic, and he himself had translated little-known Arabic Christian texts. Robert also relayed to me a very revealing and sincere story of the breadth of Sidney Griffith's intellectual influences on his own scholarship, and no doubt others as well. In his own words, Robert wrote, "It was through Sidney Griffith that I became seriously interested in the study of Islam. And this interest compelled me to take up the study of Arabic in the classes of Muhammad Sawai when I joined the faculty of the University of Virginia in 1985. Robert, of course, for those who attended his lecture last month, also praised Sidney again for a large audience in the Harrison Institute. I will conclude this introduction with Robert Wilkins' final words of praise for this greatly admired intellectual confrere. These again are Robert's words. "Sidney Griffith is a scholar of the first rank." And with those words, I'll call Sidney and welcome him to the University of Virginia and St. Anselm Institute.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, and thank you, Robert, for what was a fairly frightening introduction. To be so highly recommended, how shall I say? Well, it gives one a bit of fright. I hope that in the course of our time together this evening, we will have the opportunity to hear about some important Christian thinkers whose names are unfamiliar to most of us and whose geography and whose language will probably also be unfamiliar to many of us. I brought along some handouts, but alas, I only brought 30 copies of each of four of them, so I apologize if obviously not everyone will have gotten access to those handouts. I brought them along because the names may be somewhat unfamiliar, and I thought it might help if one could actually see the names. But perhaps we can make do with what we have. And I am also, like a typical professor, of course, right on the blackboard, and I'm happy to see that it is an actual blackboard. Onward with the more serious matters. By the year 732 A.D., just 100 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, Arab military forces in the name of Islam consolidated their hegemony over a large stretch of territory outside of his native Arabia. This expanse of territory, embracing major portions of the Roman and Persian empires of late antiquity, included many indigenous Christian communities in several different denominations. They all came under Muslim rule. But demographically, they made up the religious majority in many places until well into the 11th century and even beyond in many parts of the Middle East. There were strong Christian communities in Spain. The Arabs called it Al-Andalus, and in the territories of the former Oriental Patriarchates of the Roman Empire, as well as in Persian Mesopotamia and eastward. During the first four centuries of the Hijra, the ways in which Muslims count the years, most of these Christian subjects of the Muslim caliphs gradually adopted the Arabic language, while retaining to a greater or lesser extent, depending on local circumstances, their traditional patristic and liturgical languages for church purposes. With this historical preamble in mind, we begin this evening our inquiry into the life and accomplishments of some of the Christians in this world of Islam, particularly in the early Islamic period. We undertake the inquiry with the conviction that some knowledge of the ways in which the Christians who have historically lived with Muslims from the very beginnings of Islam will be a source of valuable insights for the ongoing encounters of Christians and Muslims, even now in the 21st century, well beyond the borders of the historical homelands of Muslims, and well into the era of the global village, when Christians and Muslims find themselves living with one another worldwide, and in many areas competing with one another for the allegiance of those who believe in the one God, the creator of all that is. It's important, I think, for us to begin with the reminder that Arabic-speaking Christians were in the audience to whom the Quran first addressed the Word of God, as it claimed, in a clear Arabic tongue. Indeed, the Quran presumes the priority of the Torah and the Gospel in the consciousness of its hearers. And it insists that in reference to the earlier divine revelations, it is itself, as the Quran says, quote, a corroborating scripture in the Arabic language to warn wrongdoers and to announce good news to those who do well. The end of the quotation. In the Quran, God advises the Muslims, quote, if you are in doubt about what we have sent down to you, ask those who were reading scripture before you. The end of the quotation. The Quran presumes in its readers a ready familiarity with the stories of the principal narrative figures of the Old and New Testaments, as well as with an impressive array of Jewish and Christian lore, faith, and practice. The Quran also warns the Christians not to go to excess in their religion and not, quote, to follow the fancies of a people who went astray in the past and led others astray and themselves strayed from the right path. The end of the quotation. The Quran also offers a critique of Christian faith and practice in a number of places. But the most comprehensive verse addressed directly to Christians is this following one. It comes from Surah 4, or chapter 4 of the Quran, verse 171. And it says this, O people of the book, do not exaggerate in your religion. And do not say about God anything but the truth. The Messiah, Jesus, Mary's son, is only God's messenger and his word he imparted to Mary and a spirit from him. Believe in God and in his messengers and do not say three. Stop it. It will be better for you. That's my somewhat free translation. God is but a single God. He is too exalted for anything to become a son to him. Anything in the heavens or anything on the earth, God suffices as a refuge. The end of the quotation. Given this level of knowledgeable critique of Christian doctrine and taking cognizance of the Quran's presumption of a Christian presence in its immediate audience, the question arises naturally about the identity of the Christians in Arabia in Muhammad's day. But the Quran itself does not offer much help to answer the question. The Quran speaks of Christians only obliquely. The Quran mentions, for example, the people of the gospel only one time. Some 14 times, it refers to people who call themselves Nazarenes or Nazareans. But in the context we can usually see, they mean people whom we call Christians. But the fact is that the Quran never actually uses term Christians, preferring for the most part to include the Christians along with the Jews and sometimes others among those it calls people of the book, or scripture people, as I think the more correct translation of the Arabic phrase Ahl-Kitab in this context might mean. So even when you look into your English translation of the Quran and you see the word Christian or Christians occurring some 14 times, it's not really there. So we can talk about that later if you want to. Presumably, the Christians whom the Arabic Quran had in mind when speaking of those who say, "We are Nazarenes," were simply Arabic-speaking Christians. And given the probability that the Quran's Arabic term here is actually reflecting a Syriac term, the etymology of which I won't go into at the moment, the likelihood, according to me, but I should hasten to say that there are people who have other opinions, is that the Christians, the Arabic-speaking Christians, who would have been in the milieu of the Quran in the first third of the 7th century, were in fact Arabic-speaking representatives of those major groups of Christians already in its world in late antiquity, all around the periphery of Arabia, and in particular to the north and east, and most specifically Aramaic-speaking Christians, whose language we normally call Syriac. There is much in the Quran, in fact, that reminds anyone who knows a bit of Syriac of what he has read in that language. And there's a big controversy, as you may know, about the influence of the earlier Aramaic, Syriac, and other late antique languages on the Arabic language of the Quran. But for the most part, I think it's fair to say that the Christians who would have been in the milieu of Muhammad and the Quran in the first third of the 7th century would have been those whom others, Muslims and others, normally referred to using the names Melkites, Jacobites, and Nestorians. Now, these are simply three names of three different Christian communities. One of the handouts that you have available lists the Christian communities in the Middle East, both in historic times and presently. It's somewhat complicated matter to untangle all the groups and use the proper titulature to refer to them. I won't take our time now to do that, but the Jacobites, the Melkites, and the Nestorians, all three groups own what we call the Nicene-Constantinopolitan Creed. I think that's an important thing to remember about the Arabic-speaking Christians in the milieu of Muhammad and the Quran. And they were communities that possessed the canonical scriptures, most of them that we are familiar with. So it's not quite convincing to me to think that they were small, isolated, heretical groups somehow unaccountably lost in the Arabian Peninsula, as one gets the impression some people might think. A lot, of course, depends on how one interprets and thinks about certain passages in the Quran, because the fact remains that the only textual evidence that we actually have at hand that can give us any idea about Arabic-speaking Christians prior to the rise of Islam is the Quran itself. So you see how much depends on a reasonable interpretation of the Quran and the passages in it which refer to Christians, their teachings, and their beliefs. There's quite a controversy, as you may know, among people who study the origins of Islam about the dating and even the geographical location of the origins of Islam. But for our purposes, I think it's important just to think of it as a religious movement that grew up in the first third of the 7th century in an Arabic-speaking milieu, probably in the environs of the modern Arabian city of Medina, and possibly Mecca earlier, and that there was a person named Muhammad who was the spokesperson and progenitor of this particular religious tradition, which in its origins was certainly open to Judaism and to Christianity, but also adopted a posture of critique with regard to the Jews and the Christians, not only in terms of what they believe, but also in terms of their religious practices. So this happened in the first third, or this religious movement was born in the first third of the 7th century. But as I mentioned at the very beginning of my talk, within one century, it had actually spread to those broad geographical reaches to which I referred in the beginning. And those geographical areas were home to many communities of Christians. So my principal concern is with those Christians who came to live under Muslim rule, to learn about their history and their ways of thinking, and to ask questions about how did they respond to the challenge of Islam, whose very language they had now adopted as their own public language. It's fair to say, I think, that it took about 50 or 60 years before we find any mention of a new religious movement among the Arabs in texts written by Christians, be it in Greek or Syriac or any other early Christian language, but principally in Greek and Syriac. But certainly, by the beginning of the 8th century, and certainly even doubly by the middle of the 8th century, we do begin to find references to what we can recognize as Islam. But the very first Christian text written by a Christian in Arabic is one that, on internal evidence, we can date with some security to the middle of the 8th century. So therefore, around the year 750, 755, maybe as far as 770. The problem is, as one goes from one calendrical system to another, there are differences in calculating the days and months and years. So bringing them into some kind of coincidence is a bit on the tricky side. But if you have in front of you the paper that has at the top some important Christian writers in the world of Islam, you will notice that the fourth item on that paper speaks of a treatise called On the Triune Nature of God. Unknown Arabic author of a treatise called On the Triune Nature of God. That is the year, around 755 or so. This is a text written in Arabic, which is kept in the library of the Monastery of St. Catherine in Mount Sinai. It's still there. You can go visit it, although it's a little tricky these days. The interesting thing about this particular text is not only that it is Christian theology written in defense of the articles of faith in the doctrine of the Incarnation and the doctrine of the Most Holy Trinity, but it's written in good Arabic. It quotes the Bible in Arabic some 68 times in testimony fashion as proof texts in service of the truthfulness of the Christian doctrines. But it also quotes from the Quran and mentions the Quran by name and quotes a number of passages from the Quran. It not only mentions the Quran by name, it not only quotes a number of passages from the Quran, but the whole first part of this treatise on the triune nature of God has been purposely composed in the idiom of the Quran. Now, this is something you have to be able to read Arabic to credit. So you might just have to take my word for it. But the interesting thing is that a now unknown Christian writer at this early period was not only very familiar with the Quran, but could even quote it accurately, I might say, and to use the quotations in an effort to prove the credibility of central Christian doctrines. It's interesting that this first text that we know of, that has come down to us, written by a Christian in Arabic, is already facing the theological problem that would become standard in the works of later Christian writers in the Arabic language. But on the other hand, how many, I won't ask for a show of hands, have heard of Yahya ibn Adi, a very important Christian intellectual who lived in the city of Baghdad in the late 9th century and lived most of his life actually in the 10th century. The mention of Baghdad brings me to the next important point about Christians living in the world of Islam that I'd like to devote some time to. And it has to do with the role that Christian intellectuals living in the Islamic world played in the formation of classical Islamic intellectual life. Because once Christians found their tongues, so to speak, in the Arabic language, they did not write only about theology. They did not just translate from previously composed Christian classics and scriptures. They also devoted themselves to writing about the intellectual issues of the day. And in that process, of course, made some major contributions to the culture and the intellectual life of the Islamic world in the classical period. And I'd like to talk about that just a bit. The mention of the name of Yahya ibn Adi gives us an entree to that topic. Many people know that Arabic-speaking Christians played a role in translating philosophical texts originally composed in Greek into Arabic. And this indeed is a project that got underway in the city of Baghdad in the late 8th century, carried on to the middle of the 11th century. this business of translating Greek philosophical and scientific texts was an undertaking that Christians had engaged in actually long before the rise of Islam, because Eastern Syriac Aramaic speaking Christians had discovered the helpfulness of treatises, particularly by Aristotle, and particularly Aristotle's logical works, for their own articulation of their Christian doctrines. And so there was quite a project to translate, especially the logical works of Aristotle, but also some metaphysical works, into Syriac in the two centuries or so prior to the rise of Islam. And on the paper that you have available, I've mentioned the names of some of these translators, people who translated texts from Greek into Syriac, Greek philosophical texts, Aristotle, for the purpose of helping them articulate Christian theology in philosophical terms. But with the arrival of the Muslims, and especially with the establishment of the city of Baghdad in the year 762-763, Muslims themselves became very interested in not only Greek philosophy, Greek logic, and Aristotelian thought, but also medical texts, mathematical texts, physics, optics, you name it. None of this had been previously available in Arabic. And Christian thinkers, Christian scholars, were very active in the project to translate these texts into Arabic. But my point was, or is, that they not only participated in translating the texts, they also participated in philosophizing and dialogue with the texts. And so, a man like Yaqub Adi, whose name I mentioned earlier, was not only a translator of texts into Arabic, but he, in his lifetime, was the recognized Aristotelian scholar of Baghdad in his era. He was the leader of the Baghdadi Peripatetic School of Philosophy in Arabic. He had a Christian teacher, a man who's also listed on your paper, Abu Bishr Bakr ibn Yunus, but he also had a Muslim teacher, a famous philosopher by the name of Al-Farabi. While many people know the name of Al-Farabi, who studied the history of philosophy, few people have heard of Yaqub Adi, and yet he was Al-Farabi's student. And it was he, Yaqub Adi, who played an important role in passing along the philosophical tradition to other students, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, eventually to a man called Ibn Sina, whom we in the West call Avicenna. So this just gives us a little peek into the intellectual life that Arabic-speaking Christians were involved with in the very heyday of the birth of classical Arabic culture, you could argue. And Yaqub Adi, this Christian thinker and writer, like his teacher Al-Farabi, was interested in how the study of philosophy could commend ideas to people of his day about how people of different communities, even different religious communities, could live in harmony with one another. It's very interesting that, to me at least, that a Christian intellectual living in Baghdad in the 10th century could address himself to this topic. And he, like his teacher Al-Farabi, seems to have thought that the best way that people can live together in harmony is if in their several communities, as he put it, in their churches and in their mosques, if their teachers could find effective ways to commend the practice of virtue and the extirpation of vices. Now, as one would study his text, or for that matter, the text of Al-Farabi, one could readily see the Aristotelianized Neoplatonism of late antiquity coming to expression in his text, as in his teacher Al-Farabi's text. But the interesting part of it, for me, is that he seems to be recognizing the plurality of religious convictions, even the antipathy between the several religious communities, and the possibility that with a sound philosophy, as he would think of it, nevertheless, these communities could find a way not only to live in harmony, but they could find a way to encourage one another to cultivate those very habits of thought and action that would commend a value that he called, using the Arabic word al-insaniya. A lot of Arabic-speaking people immediately use the English word humanism to translate that term, but that would be a mistake because our English word humanism bespeaks another whole phenomenon, a range of ideas that would not have been in the mind of either Al-Farabi or Yahya ibn Adi or other thinkers of this period, Christians and Muslims, all of them use this term, but they meant by it what we might call a humane way of life involved in cultivating virtues and extirpating vices. Well, there are other things one could say about the topics addressed by Arabic-speaking Christians living in the Islamic world in the early Islamic period. But what I hope to have communicated so far is simply to show that not only did Christians learn Arabic and begin to write in Arabic and to cultivate a whole ecclesiastical life in Arabic, but together with Arabic-speaking Muslims and Arabic-speaking Jews living in the Islamic world, all three were instrumental in the creation of the classical Islamic culture of this early Islamic period. Of course, it's also important to remember that in those days, Christians were in the majority. For a number of centuries, there's somewhat of a debate about at what point in history were most people Muslims. When did most people, when could you say most people are now Muslims in the Middle East? Well, it seems to have varied in various locations, but in the area that is today Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, the Holy Land, Egypt's a special case. Egypt is always a special case. It seems that it wasn't until around the 12th century or so that Christians were no longer the majority, that their numbers began to dwindle. Of course, until today, when Christians are, for all practical purposes, demographically insignificant in the Middle East. But for many, many long centuries, they were not. And they played a major role in the construction of what we call classical Islamic culture. By the time we get to the 13th and 14th centuries, intellectual life in the Islamic world had shifted from Baghdad to Cairo for a simple reason. In the year 1258, the Mongols destroyed the city of Baghdad. Of course, it grew up again out of the ashes. But by that time, the baton of learning, so to speak, had passed to Cairo. And the intellectuals of Cairo, be they Christian or Muslim, are a very interesting group of people to study. And there's almost everything to study. Very few Western scholars study any of the works of the Christian intellectuals of Cairo, although there were many. And we know their names, we know their works, we even have the manuscripts of their works. But like the church, we need vocations. So the people who are willing to study these texts. And one of the very interesting things that we find in studying the texts, either those written by Muslims or those written by Christians, we notice how the interreligious tensions have become stronger. And the Muslim writers are writing in much more polemical ways in 13th and 14th century Cairo than earlier Muslim anti-Christian writers had written. And they became much more knowledgeable about Christian teaching, Christian life, Christian scriptures. In other words, they've done their homework quite well. Together with my students at the Catholic University of America in Washington this semester, for example, we're reading a text written by a Muslim jurist in the 13th century in which it becomes clear that he has consulted Christian texts. He quotes the Bible in very good Arabic, very accurate quotations, and argues in a very strenuous way against major Christian doctrines, quoting in the process local Arabic-speaking Christian writers whose names we know and whose works we have. So Cairo, as opposed to Baghdad, has become a place where interreligious polemics seems to dominate over the more, shall we say, philosophical and even civic concerns of the earlier writers. Well, it's an exciting area to work in, and one that we can learn a lot from, it seems to me. But I noticed the clock on the wall keeps ticking, and Charles didn't give me permission to speak all evening. So hopefully, in the few things I've been able to bring up, you will find topics that will be interesting to you, about which you might want to learn more. But for me, beyond just the scholarly interest in these matters, which is important in itself, in our time and place, I think the work of Christian intellectuals who have lived among Muslims for centuries, they have to be important to us now, in our time, who are learning how to live together with Muslims, certainly in Western Europe, even much more so than here in the United States, but even here in the United States, and I think even more in the future. What lessons can we learn from our brothers and sisters who have lived among Muslims for so many centuries, whose voices we seldom ever hear? And one thing that comes through loud and clear, it seems to me, in all the texts written in Arabic by Christians in this early period, is that they had an adequate idea of the teachings of Islam. They knew it accurately. All you have to do is read almost any American newspaper to know that accurate ideas about Islam are not widespread. So Christian writers from this early period can give us a lot of lessons about how it is that Christians can live together with Muslims, even join with Muslims in thinking about the best ways in which society can be organized and things of this sort, and freedom of religious expression can be espoused. But alas, it's a hard sell in both communities. But at least we have the example of our Christian ancestors in the Eastern world to look to. And so perhaps with that small homiletic note, I bring my remarks to a close. Thank you for your attention.
Just a little bit louder so everybody can hear. Yeah.
One thing that you mentioned briefly that was really interesting to me was that hagiographical texts also get translated into Arabic.
Yes.
And I'm just curious how much of cultic devotion was shared by other cultures? How much, what Muslims think about the Christian saints? Were they, I'd be really interested if other communities had special devotions to like the same figures. And if Islam has its own sort of hagiographical tradition, would that not be another?
Yeah, did everyone hear the question?
No.
Okay.
The question
was raised since I said that Arabic-speaking Christians were interested in translating saints' lives into Arabic. Are there instances in which both Christians and Muslims are interested in Christian saints and Muslim saints, for that matter? And is veneration of saints and holy people a place where, say, Muslims and Christians could meet? It's a very interesting question, and like every question, it's complicated, all right? It's true that in the very earliest archive of Christian texts in Arabic that we have, there are translations of lives of saints, particularly monastic saints, because remember, the first people actually to adopt writing Arabic, first Christian people, seem to have been the monks of the Holy Land. So they translated, for example, Cyril of Scythopolis' lives of the Palestinian monks. That's one of the earliest texts. They translated texts of early Christian martyrs. They wrote lives of martyrs, even those who died under Islam. And of course, it took a while for this sort of genre to appear under Muslim auspices, but eventually it did, along with the growth of particularly Sufism at a later time. And in we have very fascinating remarks, especially in Christian chronicles, written in Syriac and in Arabic, about Muslims coming to Christian shrines to pray. We even have some instances where it seems Muslims and Christians were praying together in the same spaces, but praying differently, obviously. So there are some references to that sort of phenomenon in the early texts. But as time went on, you can still find in some places in Cairo, in some places in Syria, a place called Sinai, for example, You can find in Turkey, particularly around the shrines in Ephesus. It's not unusual for Muslim people to come to pray in these places. Now, obviously, the prayers are different. And there are people in the Muslim community who think that those Muslim people should not be praying at Christian shrines. So it's a complicated matter, but there are instances of it. I guess that's not saying a lot, but somebody else, yes.
I wonder if you could tell us how you came to this area of study. And then secondly, if you in recent years have been brought into contemporary things.
Did everybody hear that question? Well, I don't know that it would help anybody in particular to know the answer, but I belong to a religious congregation, and when I was in seminary, the superiors were always looking for people they could send on to school for studies, they called it, so that we would in turn teach in the institutions of our order, a very common thing. And they sent me on for biblical studies. And in order to do biblical studies, you had to go study Semitic languages. And so I studied Hebrew and Akkadian and Ugaritic and all these things. But in the process, for comparative purposes, I took Arabic classes and Syriac classes. And then, which I hadn't known before, I discovered that, my gosh, there's all this interesting stuff that nobody's ever seemingly worked on much. And all of a sudden, it looked a lot more exciting than one time around about all the book of Isaiah. So that's what happened to
I will change the tone a little bit. I'm interested in some practical aspects of these Christians who lived under Muslim rule. As someone whose ancestors lived for 500 years under the Ottoman rule, were these people second-class citizens, or could they own land and property, these Christians? And how was it, through what mechanism did their numbers dwindle and diminish? Gradually, over the centuries.
Well, that too is, of course, a complicated question. I'd like to address it this way. I don't know if you had the handouts that I passed around, but one of them contains the conditions that for the life of non-Muslim people under Muslim rule that is part of the legal heritage of Islam. And it stipulates how people who are not Muslims, but who nevertheless are scripture people, how they are to live under Muslim rule. And if you happen to have access to that paper, you will notice that it speaks in the first person. We agree to do this. We agree not to do that. The origins of these stipulations seems to have been in the treaties that were drawn up in the time of the Muslim conquest, when the Arab Muslims conquered this city, that city, the other city. Certain stipulations were made. For example, if the city put up no resistance, then there would be respect of life, there would be respect of property, there would be respect of places of worship, and all this sort of thing. But gradually, over a period of time, as all these things were gathered together, a consistent way of dealing with ruling non-Muslim people who lived under an Islamic government came to be formed. And of course, it's the development is somewhat complicated, but basically, the arrangement theoretically was that people of the book were free to follow their religion. They were free to own their property. They were free to engage in business, but they had to pay a special tax to the government that was called the jizya.